So hopefully you're all here to hear about variable annuities. I guess obviously continues to be a topical subject as we see more and more of these types of developments come into the Australian market. So without further ado, I'll just introduce the two speakers for today. And they've asked me to let you know that despite the accents that you'll hear, they're both ingrained in Australian society. So, and are running the half marathon on the weekend just to prove it. So, firstly, we've got Warren Manners. So, Warren's the head of actuarial market risk management, retirement investment solutions for ING Australia. And he was appointed the head of that in that position in November 2008. So, as many of you may know, ING have recently launched a lifetime income product. Warren started his career with ING in the US. As Head of Operations and Performance Management, and more recently, Head of Advanced Financial Modelling for the US Market Risk Management Division. He's accompanied today by Jeff Gebler. So Jeff is a consultant with Milliman's Sydney practice, and his responsibilities include managing variable annuity, dynamic hedging programs, and assisting clients with product development, capital requirements, and the management of this business. So Jeff has been working with Milliman since 2004, originally based in the Chicago office, and has been in the Sydney office for the last few years. So with that, I'll hand it over.
G'day. That's the only Australian I know. So today we're going to discuss some of the key lessons learned in the past. Let me know if in the back you're having trouble hearing me. You know, I came from the VA space in the U.S., and I've seen some of the issues that they encountered. In fact, that was, I suspect, one of the reasons why I was attractive to the people who hired me here, was sort of taking some of those lessons with me over to here. So I'll walk through some of those and what some of the solutions that some companies have taken to try and mitigate some of those past issues. And then Jeff's going to come up and talk to you about specifically one of the key tools that's currently used to manage some of the risks in variable annuities, specifically dynamic hedging. So, you know, annuities, variable annuities are you know, fairly new animal. Annuities are a fairly old animal. Early on, 70s and 80s, they were really just in the U.S. In particular, they were a tax-deferred vehicle. There was some death benefit payout, but there was nothing guaranteed about it. You would just get whatever was left in your annuity. But those were fairly tame. Then they started to go the variable annuity route. CIA CREF, which is the big pension fund out in California, they were pretty big at offering variable annuities. They still are, but they don't offer any of the so-called guarantees that we're all used to hearing about and seeing nowadays. Again, slight death benefit, small death benefit, return of premium. In fact, early on, they wouldn't even price for it. They wouldn't even charge. They just figured it was so de minimis. Around the early to mid-90s, they started to, offer up some enhanced death benefits. And they did start to charge. Whether they charged sufficient amounts is still open for debate, but they started to get richer. So rather than just return whatever you had originally put into the product, they'll offer you that plus maybe a little bit return, or sort of offer any upside that you might have received through market growth, through ratchets. By the way, I'm sort of going under the assumption that everyone here is familiar with the sort of basics of annuities. When I say ratchets and roll-ups, I'm going under the assumption you know what I'm talking about. If not, feel free to raise your hand and I'll expound or ask me afterwards. So death benefits were the first sort of foray into investment-type guarantees. Then they started to offer up living benefits. Particularly as the market started to heat up for these things. A lot of competitors in there. It was a profitable product. had some good ROE metrics around it. So people were getting involved in it quite a bit, insurance companies. So they started to offer ABs, which sort of guarantees a certain account level at a certain point in time, very European option-like. And then GMIBs, which is you have to annuitize to reap the benefits of it, but it was just providing a certain guaranteed stream of income. Then WBs came into the picture, these guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefits, and really the impetus behind the GMWBs was to get around the distaste that normal fixed annuities had. I mean, annuities, I think, worldwide tends to be a four-letter word, and that's because of some of the downside. You lose access to the principal, so you pay it, you die the next day, it's gone. People don't like that idea. And you don't really have access to the capital to invest it the way you want. So GMWBs were sort of a way around that, where you were still given liquidity and you were still given an ability to invest in certain mutual funds or fixed income funds that you liked, but it didn't have the, you know, so it looked and smelled like an annuity, but it wasn't. Then the living benefits started to pick up. So WBs with ratchets and roll-ups, hybrid products, that's hybrid GMWB, that's supposed to be GMIB, not DMIB. And then, you know, towards mid to latter part of the 2000s, lifetime WBs, some spousal lifetime WBs, doubling benefits if policyholders enter nursing homes. Oftentimes they would try to give you a tax boost. If you wait a certain amount of time, they give you an extra 15 or 20% on top of your guarantee. So ever, ever richer. And as the title suggests, there was quite a significant benefits war going on. A lot of players, big market. People were trying to get as much market share as they could. So, you know, the GFC hits and you know, these VA providers took some hits like everyone else in the world, particularly those who weren't hedging, but even those who were hedging ran into some issues. And this is a short list. This is obviously not comprehensive, but this touches on some big ticket items. Just a lack of understanding of the risks embedded in these products. You know, these were early on, it was predominantly actuaries running these things. And while they had investment background and they understood option pricing theory, it wasn't sort of Wall Street type of understanding. And so, you know, towards mid to late 2000s, that's when insurance companies started to try and attract some Wall Street experience just to gain some of that insight and help understanding why your P&L is moving the way it is, where your risks are attributed, and then be able to act upon that information. Accounting asymmetries, as it happens, one of the nice things about Australia is there's some nice consistency in the way P&L is treated in terms of liabilities and hedge assets, or sort of derivatives, if you will, as well as on the capital side. And that I think lends itself to it encourages managing and hedging risks. In the U.S., that wasn't always the case. You had sort of smoothing filters, these accounting filters that would come in. And, you know, insurance companies would manage to say the economics. They'd hedge to the economics, but their liabilities weren't moving according to the same mechanics. And so you'd get nothing, very little movement on the liability side of the balance sheet, and your derivatives were swinging all over the place. And then to get on a conference call with analysts and say, we're hedging the economics, not the GAAP earnings, is, oh, we don't care. You guys look terrible. What's going on there? A lot of P&L volatility. And so it was a source of angst, to say the least. Very silo-based. Pricing does their thing. Product development does their thing. Accounting does their thing. Hedging does their thing. Quite often in where I was based in the U.S., product development would come up with, you know, just some crazy ideas. They'd push it through management, and then they would, you know, they'd go out and start marketing this thing and then lob it over the wall to the hedging team and say, okay, guys, you know, it's a daily ratchet with a 7% roll-up on top of that. take care of it. You know, plenty of managed funds. There's a little property in there. So when I came over here and we were setting up the business unit within ING, one of the things that was very pleasing was that a lot of that was sort of, there was no more silo mentality. Pricing, accounting, product development, operations, hedging, all that was integrated. In fact, my own opinion is that it's the hedging side of the house that should actually be driving the product development side of things. And then insufficient hedging programs. Again, it was actuaries running the show, and they didn't really have the sophistication and level of understanding that they really needed. So models weren't quite sophisticated enough. They were running things quite often, you know, in Excel, on, you know, a grid of computers that weren't well integrated. And so it wasn't productionized, let's put it that way. Oftentimes you were forced not to hedge the economics because a management wanted to hedge your P&L or they wanted to hedge the capital end of things. And the last point is of particular importance, tracking error not given enough consideration. So that gets back to this idea of, you know, offering underlying funds, you know. At one point we had 250-plus managed funds that we were trying to sort of, you know, hedge against, many of which were managed, virtually all of which were managed. Very, very difficult to do. So what were some of the lessons that came out of there? You know, providers have now started to pull back. So there's fewer bells and whistles, less frequent ratchets, lower roll-ups, much better management reporting, a better understanding of what's important, what are the risks, how do they stack up. And probably most importantly, one of the big issues in the U.S., in large part because of the accounting asymmetry, is you guys are doing something over there in a black box. I want to know how that makes its way into my P&L, which goes through all these filters. So that understanding wasn't always clear. They'd see their GAAP earnings flying all over the place, and they'd say, what are you guys doing? You're not doing what I thought you would be doing. And we tried to explain, and it led to some interesting conversations. Better management of the product at the fund level. So rather than offering everything and then trying to hedge it with an overlay using capital market instruments, they started, you know, there was more a focus on what do we want to offer as the underlying funds. So lower vol funds, more hedgeable, trying to manage some of the policyholder activity between switching of funds, putting in some penalties if that kind of activity was going on. You know, both capital and reserves starting to look more like a principle-based approach, market consistent. Is the term constantly thrown around? You know, starting to recognize more and more that these things are truly a package of options. I mean, nowadays that's ubiquitous, but again, early 2000s, it wasn't always the case that everyone was using option pricing theory and using where necessary stochastic pricing and hedging. And then just again, internal subject matter experts with experience hedging options in general and VAs in particular. So, you know, in ING, we actually started to actively engage Wall Street firms to see if we can attract some of that talent. So I just wanted to sort of illustrate some of those lessons learned in the product that we've offered up at ING. You know, right now the ratchet, that's actually an old slide, unfortunately. That shows a biennial ratchet. It's actually now annual. But the idea is that if you go back to the U.S., again, quarterly, some funds are actually daily. I'm not quite sure how they pull that off, but they have daily ratchets. Much more diversified funds, equity only, no credit, just government bond stuff. So we really, really tried to focus on whatever we're going to offer, let's make sure it's hedgeable. Let's offer protection on beta. Let's not necessarily try and protect alpha, because alpha is not something that you can hedge very easily, if at all. And just a small universe of funds. We've got three funds, a mix of fixed income and equity, just depending on your risk profile. and more moderate roll-ups. Again, in the U.S., they'd have like 7% compounded on top of ratchets. So it was just a very, very, very rich benefit and not always easy to hedge, and very costly to hedge as well. So, you know, the obvious question is, now this thing is a nascent market in Australia, how do we avoid some of the issues? How do we avoid a benefits war? In discussions with APRA, APRA's been pretty actively engaged in the dialogue with ourselves and other companies that are offering these types of guarantees. They're aware of what they don't know, which is a good thing because they don't try to kid themselves. They look to the rest of the world, U.S., Solvency II in Europe, just to kind of get a feel for what have been the issues and how have other government organizations responded. And so they're aware of these things, and they're likely going to vet any and all product variations that come out to try and avoid some of these escalations. Disciplined pricing and risk management approaches. On top of sort of making sure that you've got the right people in place, you really need to have a strict governance structure around that, both from a pricing perspective. So understand what your targets are and risk management. Understand what the risks are and can you actually manage those risks. Demonstrate that you can actually manage these things and identify where the slippage is. And that just takes a lot of modeling, a lot of running of models, and a lot of just working with it, hands-on experience. You start to get a feel for sifting out what's important and what isn't. Hard check at the bottom, hard checkpoints. So, you know, if sales are just flying off the shelves, you may want to ask yourself why. Is that necessarily a good thing? And then just consider it in the broad portfolio of the insurance company offerings. As that exposure gets bigger and bigger, how much of that do we actually want? Is it diversifying our portfolio, or is it concentrating even more risk into our portfolio? So just sort of understanding it from a high point is very important. Leveraging the lessons from the global VA experience, certainly. And then simple value proposition. These are by no means simple. I don't need to tell this group, but these are no means simple products. You can get yourself in trouble by creating something that is so complex. It's complex to explain to advisors. It's complex to explain to the end customer. It's complex internally to understand all that's going on and be able to identify all the risks and be able to manage them accordingly. So simple is a really good approach to take in virtually all aspects of this, funds, product features, hedging, hedging instruments. All these things really need to be taken into account. And then just some tools to help manage these VA risks. So what's in yellow there is just going to be discussed real quickly in a couple of slides. I'm quickly running out of time, so I'll speed up a little. Underlying fund selection and capital markets hedge. Again, we'll talk about those in a minute, so I'll just move down. Product features, the richer it is, the more expensive it's going to be. So you really got to be careful about what you offer. And making sure that there's a value proposition there, and then you've priced for it. You can put out anything you want. In the U.S., they tried to do that, but they weren't always pricing for it accordingly. There's a lot of subsidy between the underlying fund revenue and the product revenue. Using reinsurance, I think that's an important safety mechanism, and it's just a good tool to have in your toolkit. It also gives you sort of an external view of checking on your own pricing. Longevity swaps, it's a burgeoning field now, but I think as the market grows, it's bigger in the UK than it is here. I mean, it's not virtually non-existent here, but I think as business grows and as the VA business grows in particular, this is going to be a useful tool. And then just looking for any internal hedges that may be a natural offset. In the U.S., they have equity-indexed annuities, which are more like a call option, where VAs are more like a put option. So there's some natural diversification there that you can use to your benefit. So I wanted to touch on the underlying fund selection because I think it's a really important point. Sort of being able to identify funds that are you know, give investors what they want. I mean, the whole idea with a variable annuity is to give them exposure to capital markets, because in part that's going to help with inflation exposure, right? I mean, that's a very topical item these days. They want to see a withdrawal sort of indexed to inflation. But a lot of the products sort of take that into account through a second order mechanism, which is giving you access to some equity exposure, some upside, which you can lock in through ratchets. But with that, you also have to manage, you know, how volatile is the fund? Higher volatility, higher cost. And you're going to have to deal with what will the market tolerate in terms of a cost. So you might want to offer the most volatile thing in the world, but it's going to cost a ton and no one will buy it. And then certainly hedgeability. You want to kind of reduce tracking error as much as you can, offer beta, not so much alpha. And then liquidity. I mean, you want to make sure that whatever you're offering, there's a liquid market available to allow you to actually offset this risk. And Jeff is going to talk to you about the dynamic hedging piece.
Thanks, Warren. So similar to Warren, variable annuities were my ticket out to Australia. I was at a conference a couple weeks ago where a presenter was American and had a lot of analogies to American football and some good video clips, which I really enjoyed, but I don't think the crowd did, so I'll just stick to some text and flow charts. So I just want to start out just kind of going through the main VA market risks. So Warren's talked about a lot of the other risks, but we'll just focus on market risks here. So probably the most important one is delta, and that's your sensitivity to the underlying asset price. And again, as Warren said, the availability of equity index hedges is really what determines the funds that you offered on. So these are really liquid contracts, you know, ASX 200, S&P 500, and even if you start offering more kind of exotic emerging markets, there's pretty deep markets in, say, you know, South Korea, Hong Kong. Another thing that people are starting to use that I didn't have up there are total return swaps, so swapping out equity returns for fixed interest payments. Rho is, that's your sensitivity to interest rates, and it really varies by product type and how sensitive you are to interest rates. So if you look at a product like Axon North, maybe one of the more short-term guarantees, their interest rate sensitivity isn't so much, but if you look at Money for Life, which is a long-term income guarantee, there really is quite a bit of interest rate sensitivity. So the natural hedge for that is going to be interest rate swaps, and one reason for that is that your companies are usually marking these liabilities to the interest rate swap curve, so therefore the hedging with the interest rate swaps give them the offset that they're looking for. But on the other hand, we do see a lot of people using bond futures, so government bond futures. Those are typically only available at shorter durations. In the U.S., we see companies using a lot of swap futures, not quite as liquid as the underlying swaps themselves, but there's some benefits in that they're exchange-traded, and it eliminates some of the cash flows. Swaptions, those are options on a swap. Not purely a row hedge, it's more the volatility of row you're hedging, but you can also use it as kind of a tail risk interest rate measure. And then Vega, that's your sensitivity to volatility. The most popular hedge for that would be equity index options. Most commonly it's put options. Variance swaps are starting to be used now. They're kind of theoretically appealing because they pay off with regard to realized volatility, whereas the options are paying off based on implied volatility. Although there's some drawbacks to the variance swaps because their payoffs are a function of variance and not volatility. So interestingly, some companies that were holding these before the GFC were kind of overhedged because they volatility shot up, but they got a payoff based on variance, which is volatility squared. So the overhedge was a benefit for them. Finally, another big one is currency risk. Australia, that's a big thing because investors are typically investing anywhere from half or maybe more of their money in foreign equities. But then, as you know, as Warren said, that's the kind of thing that you can handle it within in the fund. So some companies take the view, why offer the policyholders exposure to currencies when it's just going to need to be hedged by our hedging program? And then at the bottom there, these risks aren't necessarily less, but they're not typically viewed in the same framework of kind of first order hedging. So gamma, realized volatility, and Vega, those are all kind of intertwined. Basis risk, so that's the risk that your fund mapping doesn't quite match the actual performance of the funds. That's the main kind of basis risk that people look at. But there's also basis risk. in the sense that if you're hedging maybe a 30-year swap curve with a 10-year bond future, there's basis risk there. Also, if you're hedging with government bonds and you're exposed to the interbank swap rate, that's another source of basis risk. And then liquidity, so that kind of manifests itself in a lot of ways. You know, a lot of Australian funds have high exposure to properties, so if there's not there are property derivatives out there, but they're not quite as liquid as some of the equity derivatives. So I should have highlighted it, but daily liability valuations, that's a massive shift from kind of a traditional insurance business where you might be valuing your life insurance book quarterly or monthly. This really becomes a very instantaneous process. So most companies are going to value the liability of their guarantees every day. Some companies might value them even more if they have significant global exposure. One thing on the left side there, I have the kind of the policyholder data and the admin system. So one of the main pieces of conducting your liability valuations is having up-to-date information on your policyholders. So that includes their investment balances. It includes their guarantee balances. It includes demographic factors. So in the U.S., where they had sold variable annuities for a long time before they ever started hedging them, they already had that information sitting there. They decided to pull the data off. Here in Australia, where variable annuities with guarantees are being introduced all at once, it's a significant challenge and one that's often underestimated. So companies have either modified their existing admin systems to handle these guarantees, or they might just go out and buy a whole new system specifically for the purpose of the guarantee. So over on the right, we just see all the other inputs that are flowing into these valuation models. Capital market parameters, calibrated daily using live, you know, live swap curves, live volatility quotes, also demographic assumptions. And what this there's a lot of challenges to these to the demand of having valuations done so quickly. So there's a lot of ways to get around that. Due to the nature of policies, each policy is a unique guarantee. So usually those are valued on a seriatim basis, which can be done with distributed computing. Also, companies are exploring things such as cluster modeling, where they're trying to go through their in-force block and see how they can condense it in a more intelligent manner. And then where this kind of comes together is with the asset liability management. And so this, you know, I'm talking about these things in the hedging of variable annuities, but it also pertains to a lot of other risk business or protection strategies. The management of this is you combine the liability Greeks, so those are your sensitivities, your liability, along with the Greeks of any assets that you already have on the books, and that gives you your net exposure. So with a simple hedging strategy, it might be a matter of just matching up instruments one-to-one, but then if you lay on an equity index option, for example, which you're using to hedge Vega, well, then that index option also has delta and rho, so then your existing positions need to account for that. And then your trading software needs to be able to value all the options that you could be using at any point in time, and that'll take into account your trading strategy. That trading strategy can include things such as rebalancing thresholds. So most companies aren't going to rebalance their delta as soon as it falls out of line. They might have a threshold to account for the fact that markets might move up and down during the day. And then based on that, you know, these get sent to the traders, to the trading floor, and then the system will also track existing assets. And this is a thing that gets monitored around the clock. So if you have exposure to the global equity markets, we have offices here in Sydney as well in Chicago and London. So it's a thing that the trading books are passed around the globe continuously. And we've seen a lot of companies, you know, they might staff up with as many as 20 people to run these types of programs. You might have different traders for different instruments. So you have certain traders working on the futures. You might have a different trader that's trading options exclusively, and then one that's trading interest rate swaps, depending on the volumes that you're seeing. So the Australian markets are, I guess you could say, they're punching above their weight in terms of country size relative to the size of the depth of the capital markets. Very liquid. The the ASX 200 index future and the government bond futures are probably the most widely traded contracts in their classes. But there's some peculiarities to the market here. As everybody knows, interest rates are pretty high. Also, there's high dividends, which have tax advantages. Looking at the chart here, this is looking at the March ASX 200 futures contract, equity futures contract. And what we've done here is we're showing kind of the path that the contract took over the 3 month life of the contract, and we've adjusted out movements in the underlying. So this is just showing, really just graphing the difference in the theoretical value of the future related to the actual path of the future. And there's a couple things going on. You have if you have any dividend surprises or interest rate surprises, so your expected value of the contract is based on your futures pricing formula. And you can see that it deviates quite a bit from what you'd expect. I guess in the end, it's not such a big deal because it converges to the underlying value at the end of the contract. But it's just the kind of thing that companies need to account for, that they might see deviations in their hedging and P&L due to issues such as this. And also due to the issue of the franking credits on equities here. If you're trading the futures, you would find that it's slightly more beneficial to hold the underlying for certain investors. And for that reason, the futures contracts could roll cheap by the end of the month. But if you're short the index, if you're managing a guarantee like this, that usually ends up being a good thing for you. One of the interesting things here is that the Treasury or the government bond futures are cash settled only. So in other markets, the government bonds are based on a basket cheapest to deliver bond. So what can happen is that a 10-year bond might actually price off of a 7-year bond, and that might affect your ability to hedge certain points on the yield curve. Swap market here is traded out basically out to 30 years. That's pretty much the same as the United States. In Europe, there are 50-year interest rate swaps being traded. There's some uptake of that from insurance companies. Liquidity is generally good. They're willing to trade $50 to $100 million at a single trade, although the spreads are a bit wider than in other markets. We found that the spreads on interest rate swaps are generally about twice the size of what they are in the U.S. or Europe, and then get a bit wider when tough times hit. And just another comment on the level of interest rates in the Australian market. So that, you know, the capital market parameters influence the type of guarantees that you can offer in any given market. So if you look at Japan, which has interest rates close to zero, that means that for a comparable level of benefits, that would cost much more than it would cost here in Australia. So as much as hedging is a modeling task and a computational task, it's also kind of an administrative task. So there's a lot of parties involved. Within the life insurance company, they're allocating a portion of the policyholder's premium to the hedging program, and in turn, the hedging program is supposed to be there to be able to make claim payments if the underlying investments are depleted. So there could be a large number of parties that the company is dealing with. Usually, you'd have one or maybe more futures brokers for executing your equity index futures and your bond futures. Also, would have swap dealer for trading interest rate swaps, and then you know it might be the same as your options dealer. It might not. After the global financial crisis, counterparty risk came to the forefront. So right after Lehman Brothers collapsed, that became a big issue. It wasn't before. So then people started spreading their swap and options trades over numerous parties. They also started monitoring their counterparty risk on a daily basis. For some OTC contracts, now we're seeing collateral being held. It's not necessarily the case with kind of plain vanilla swaps or options, but for more exotic contracts, collateral is being used in a lot of cases. And then the arrows going between the two here just represents that there's a lot of cash going back and forth. So if you're trading interest rate swaps, you might have swap settlements every quarter for the shorter term ones or semi-annual for the longer term ones. Futures margins are going to be going back and forth. So if you assume that markets are going to be rising on average, you would expect to be paying money continuously to your futures broker if you're short the market. But then during the GFC, what we saw is that in the U.S., it was estimated that companies had about $40 billion coming back from their futures brokers. And the interesting thing there is that they were sitting on a pile of cash. A lot of U.S. companies took advantage of high credit spreads to to invest that money. And so there's a number of different reports or lenses to view the success and performance of a hedging program. The key report that we usually generate for clients is what we call a performance attribution. The purpose of this is really just to dig into what's going on with your liabilities and your assets. And the goal is to attribute moves in your liability due to market movements and then match that up with the hedge assets that we're targeting that risk factor. But it's also important to isolate other factors besides market factors. So you're going to have changes in your liabilities due to you're going to have new business coming in throughout a week. You might have policyholders that have left the block. Policyholders are generally given the flexibility to rebalance their assets. There might be joint life policies where your mortality assumptions are going to change. The goal of all this is to determine mainly to determine the hedge effectiveness. You can also monitor assumptions. So this is where you're going to see experience deviate from what was priced with your lapse and your mortality assumptions. Interestingly, there's a lot of talk that goes on about dynamic lapse models because you have the policyholders are often free to leave the contract whenever they please. It's a general assumption that more policyholders are going to stick around when the markets tank because the guarantee is now more valuable to them. The real trouble with that, though, is that there's not so much credible experience out there. So I've recently seen experience studies by large GM death benefit writers in the United States, and they felt that they only recently had credible experience to start really calibrating these complex lapse models. And these are companies that have sold their DB books for quite a long time. And products are kind of evolving faster than these models can be calibrated. So it's kind of a gradual process. Price conservatively and monitor the assumptions and adjust models as needed. Milliman's put out a number of reports in the last couple of years. Kind of one of the key numbers that we found is that companies are reporting hedge effectiveness in the range of 94-95%. So it's important to remember that's 94% hedge effectiveness, for example, on the Greeks that they're hedging. So there are other risks that, companies that haven't been hedging. One company had large losses because they're due to changes in implied volatility, which they weren't hedging. And also, if you dig into some of the other kind of failure stories of the VA market, basis risk on the underlying funds. So some companies were selling these VA guarantees on effectively hedge funds, and they found that they had an alpha in the range of negative 10%, so that could cause a big hit to your hedging program performance. Okay, where to next? So Warren had several examples of how the products are being re-engineered to manage risk better. One of the hot topics now is target volatility. That's been included in the new Macquarie product. And what that means is it's readjusting the underlying policyholder assets between equity and fixed income or defensive assets based on the volatility in the market. If you look at a standard balanced fund, say a 60-40 fund, you could argue that's not really an allocation that's set in stone. It's just set based on the investor's tolerance for risk. So it just reasons that if volatility increases, you'd want to shift them out of growth assets. And so there's a number of ways to do that. You could use a predictive Garch model or also just track implied volatilities when it comes to shifting assets back and forth. Second thing that's going on now is moving the hedges from the insurance balance sheet to the policyholder. If you look at how these products are, the workings of it, the insurance company is collecting a premium and they're allocating a portion of that to pay for the hedge program. So there's some companies have decided that it might be a good idea to move some of that hedging into the fund itself. Now, there's a range of difficulties in doing that. Some companies have done it by maybe targeting a 10-year put option inside the fund and always having a delta rho neutral hedge position that matches that tracking option, and then that's sitting inside the policyholder's assets. So what we see, U.S. fund managers have kind of wised up to the fact that variable annuities are a significant source of income for them. If companies aren't always using internal funds, so some fund companies have tried to tailor their fund offerings to the VA market. We saw one large fund manager put out a letter to interested VA companies that here's a fund that has these delta rho neutral profiles, and it would be suitable for inclusion on your guarantee program. There's also more complicated ways to kind of replicate hedging at an individual policyholder level using a fund-to-fund approach. The final point there is interest rate-linked withdrawal benefits. So the value of the benefit can increase or decrease to the company based on interest rates, and it also can increase or decrease to the policyholder based on where interest rates are. So they might not find today's 5% guarantee very beneficial if interest rates go up to 15%. And so a floating guarantee structures like that would account for that. And so that's all that I had.
All right. Thanks, Jeff. We've got about 10 or 15 minutes for questions, and unfortunately we're short-staffed, so I'm going to be the roving microphone. So if you've got any questions, feel free to fire away. And please just indicate, you know, who you are and where you're from before you ask.
Thanks, Wayne. Nick Khalil Towers Watson. Just back on, I guess, the product design side, if you look at what's available in Australia in these products, including the ING product, from a user point of view, one of the things you notice first is that the protected income stream isn't CPI indexed. As you mentioned, you have this, I guess, indirect protection, if you like, through the ratchet, but it's not an explicit indexation. Can you explain a bit more, you know, is that just not possible in the Australian marketplace, or was it a pricing issue? And, you know, in the same sort of product overseas, is that tail income indexed?
I'm not aware of, there may be one, but I'm not aware of any company in the U.S., Jeff, you may know, that actually offers this. The problem with offering inflation indexing is it's expensive. You can offer it, but I think everyone would agree most investors want everything for nothing, and that's a tough thing to offer. So that's not to say it's not doable. I think the availability of inflation index bonds, it's not huge in Australia, but they do exist. As well as some swaps. So it's doable. It's really a question of how do you offer it that is I think one of the points that wasn't made on my slide but should be pointed out is that all constituents were not considered when a lot of these products were offered. So you can't just consider the policyholder. You have to consider the shareholder, the regulator. You know, you have to put them all in the mix. I suspect that that was maybe an issue with like Madoff funds. You know, sure, that looks great from a policyholder standpoint, but you know, I assume no one happened to the Madoff funds. So it's doable. I think you just need to find some trade-offs. Maybe you reduce some of the other benefits, or you offer it, but just for a limited time. You know, over a limited scale. If there's enough demand for it, which it certainly does seem like there is, then I'm sure companies, whether it's ING or otherwise, will come up with a solution. Before we go on to another one, I don't know if you want to add anything.
One of the issues that we see is if you, based on an attractive guarantee rate, such as 5% now, if you add in any sort of inflation benefits to that, without considering the availability of hedges, it just gets really expensive. So a 5% withdrawal rate that increases at 2% a year, for example, that becomes a 10% benefit when the policyholder is 80 years old. And then also with the derivatives are becoming more and more widely available, inflation-linked bonds. But if you look at baked into a normal interest rate instrument, part of the interest rate is an inflation premium. So you can get an inflation hedge, but it's also it's at the expense of part of your interest rate that you would assume before.
Greg Bourne from Ankura Capital. If I understand things correctly, because of your reliance on derivatives to hedge your beta risk and your inclination to have a clean match there, that disinclines you to look at variance within asset classes. So, for example, if you could do something in the Australian equities asset class to boost the sustainable level of income and reduce volatility within that asset class, that wouldn't be attractive to you because that would make the hedge a little murkier.
Make sure I understand your question. You're arguing that if there's if there's a way to sort of to get diversification to reduce the overall, but that might not be as hedgeable.
Yeah.
That would be undesirable.
Yeah.
I think that there's a component of that that needs to be considered, because again, it's really a question of where is the risk, who's taking it, how much is it, how much is the risk. If I'm able to offer a more diversified fund with a lower vol, then arguably the cost of hedging on the face of things would come down, so it might be cheaper. But then on the other end of things, you have to take into account, well, liquidity. Is there really liquidity in there that is baked into my model, right? Because these models assume that you can continuously hedge. And the fact of the matter is you can't. So I think it's – I don't think there's a silver bullet there. I think it's – you have to weigh the pros and cons. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
I think it was you, Warren, who said that these are complicated products to sell to, you know, to describe to agents, to describe to management, and to describe to whoever. I see that as a big danger, because inherently, in a protected product, should be relatively simple to sell to people out there, and you know, AXA and ING are doing that. Where does the complication come in? I can understand the complication internally. I just don't understand the complication externally. And the complication internally, to me, is a huge problem. It shouldn't be complicated to sell internally.
You want me to take that? You want to take that?
Yeah, I can follow.
I mean, complication is a relative term. The more we get, you know, the more sophisticated we get, and the longer these products exist and you garner that experience, you learn to manage that complexity. I agree with you that externally you don't want it. From the customer standpoint, it should be a simple proposition. Income for life, a guaranteed base, whatever it might be, it should be a simple proposition. I just think I'll go to the U.S. as an example, to offer that little extra bell and whistle. Someone will say, you know what, they're offering you 6% roll-up, we're going to offer you 7% roll-up, but, you know, it's only if you're born on a Tuesday and it only goes out for 10 years, and it, you know, they would add endless amounts of caveats around it. And, you know, the advisors wouldn't get it, and policyholders wouldn't get it. They'd buy them, but they wouldn't necessarily get them, and they'd get bit.
So that's mis-selling.
There are plenty of advisors who are apt to do that.
And mispricing to a certain
extent. Potentially. Certainly not on our end, but they're in.
And I think it's important to point out that Australia's had the benefit of kind of observing the global variable annuities market, and they really are on the simple end of the spectrum with the products. They are very straightforward compared to a lot of things out there, straightforward to model, straightforward to sell. If you look in Europe, there's a lot of products out there where the policyholder is depositing a regular stream of income, and then the amount of that income that gets credited to their investment account is based on a life table. So I mean, for the advisor to communicate that to the investor, I would bet that they're not fully communicating that. And then I guess the states are you know, simpler than in that regard, but then they did have richer benefits for a while.
Mike Thornton from AXA. Just a quick couple of comments on sort of the communication challenge, if I may. I think that the challenge with advisors is getting them to figure out how to use it in their business models and into their advice strategies. Clearly in Australia, we've not been in an environment where guarantees have been prevalent for some time. So there's a certain amount of unpackaging of existing advice strategies that advisors need to do in order to figure out how to plug these products in. That's certainly been the case with our existing North products and with with withdrawal for life, I expect there's a new longevity component to link in as well. On the internal communication, I think the presentation here did a good job at highlighting the range of issues that you need to contend with, be it systems to daily valuations to understanding the Greeks. And I don't think it's that any of this is necessarily conceptually challenging. It's just that there are lots of moving parts. And unless you live and breathe it regularly, it's hard to get your head around it. I liken it to my tax return. I can kind of get my head around it when I focus on it for the week I do every year. For the other 51 weeks, I couldn't care, and I'm not that interested, and I don't understand it. This is like that. Unless you live and breathe it, it's hard to really for the learnings to become embedded. So in communicating with boards and senior executives and analysts, you're always finding you're having to start at first base every time, and getting them to the third base, let alone the fourth, is really hard work.
Yeah. It's a problem for the boards, isn't it?
Yeah.
I like the baseball analogy.
Yeah. I've got probably time for another one or two questions.
I'm Paul Swinhoe. I love the irony that the measures of risk in these products are called the Greeks in the current day and age. This question is really about the risks to the product provider. You've talked about 95% hedge effectiveness. You've talked about spreads that you have to pay on your derivatives varying. And sometimes you describe the market as generally liquid, which means sometimes there's a problem. Can you quantify those problems relative to the sort of expected profit margins that you would be making? How much difference does it make to your profit from time to time because you're not perfectly hedged and because the spreads move around?
Yeah, quantifying can be difficult because if you're doing any sort of statistic based on normal markets, you know, that all falls apart when it goes. Last week was a good example. We found that there were... We just got the feedback from our traders in the States. So there were if you were unable to rebalance during that time, you would suffer losses that aren't priced for and models that assume continuous pricing. But it's important. So I don't really have an exact percentage figure to give, but it's important to consider the amount of profit margins or not profit margins, but capital margins that are included in these products to account for that. So they're generally pretty conservative here. If you look in the States where there was no pricing for, either the guarantees weren't priced for at all, or they priced for them and sold them at what was their economic cost, under the assumption that the guarantee would just benefit their funds under management. The cost can be understated if you don't take into account widening spreads, falling markets, and things like that. Warren, anything to add?
No, not really.
Jeff, it's Martin here from KPMG. I've just got a question around your discussion of the hedging program was quite interesting. One of the issues that we've spent a lot of time considering is the hedge statistic and the implications for that from a capital perspective and a profitability perspective. I was just interested in your thoughts around that issue because we have spent a lot of time on that and it's a key driver of your outcomes.
Do you mean whether or not, to the extent that the hedging effectiveness influences your pricing or the capital that you're holding?
The hedge target, I suppose, is what liability you're actually targeting with your hedging program. Are you targeting like BAL? Are you targeting policy liability? Are you targeting capital adequacy liability?
Yeah, I mean, that's what we've seen a varying range of targets in the market. Offhand, I don't have a good feel for what the long-term implications of, you know, going with one versus the other. But it's certainly an interesting issue here in the Australian market. Typically, in the States, the way the hedge target is generally always you look at the present value of your future claim payments, and then there's a portion of your premiums that you're collecting that you usually set up front to be the premiums that you need to match that. So you'd start off with a zero liability and go from there, and then if there's material changes in assumptions, then that would get revisited, and the hedge premium would get reset. The approaches are pretty varying by market.
All right, so I won't keep you from lunch any longer, but I'd like to thank Warren and Jeff for an interesting, thought-provoking presentation.